Members, we don't have quite a quorum yet, but the Met Council does have to be on their way up the ramp and out the door at 1:31. So we're going to go ahead and start the hearing, and when we get to a quorum, Mr. Shetton, I'll interrupt and we'll start the meeting, take the roll, and adopt the minutes of the last meeting. But why don't we get started with your presentation, and we'll make sure we have you on your way by 1:30, okay?
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members, my name is Judd Shetton. I'm the Government Affairs Director for the Metropolitan Council. Appreciate the opportunity to be here to speak to you with a little bit more detail regarding the council's operating budget and revenues. Mr. Chair, my understanding is that you'd like us to speak to the document that we provided you yesterday. What we've provided, or what we have here, is a presentation that is basically boils down those responses that we provided. With me today is Wes Koistra. Mr. Koistra is our CFO at the council, and he will walk you through our presentation. But we also thought it was important to, and as we discussed yesterday, we also thought it would be important to talk about the our budget with the governor's recommendation. Since we were here last, the governor restored our general fund cut, and the MBES forecast came out as part of the February forecast. So Mr. Koistra will be able to speak to that, and I appreciate you giving us the opportunity to go first and to allow us to get out the door. And I apologize for that, but it's kind of out of my control.
Well, I'm understanding you have how many new members down there today and the chair?
Mr. Chair, we have 16 new members. Yeah. The chair and the governor will be joining us this afternoon
for the swearing-in ceremony and impaneling the new Met Council. So that's a big deal. Yeah,
so tell them
we said congratulations. We're happy to accommodate you today. So, Mr. Koistra, welcome to the committee. And remind us now, are you working off the document we see on the screen behind you?
Yes.
Mr. Chair, we'll be working off the document on the screen.
Great,
and
thank
this
you.
Will, as Mr. Shetland said, it'll be a high-level review of a lot of detail that we provided to the committee upon the committee's request.
You did, and thank you for that. It's appreciated. As we, and I'll say this again, as we move forward with, we have an unusual economic urgency we're dealing with, we will be making some cuts to the general fund portion of the budget. We want to be sure we're cutting where the least harm is done and doing reforms where we can so we can continue to deliver service and so on. So thank you. Mr. Koistra, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm going to first just discuss some changes to the governor's rec on the budget, and then also some changes to the MBES forecast that came out in the recent forecast release. Mm-hmm. The governor, in his recommendation, had originally reduced bus transit appropriations by $5.4 million per year, or $10.8 million for the biennium. As a result of the new forecast, both the increases in statewide revenues and in consideration of decreases in the MBES forecast, he restored those reductions. So the governor's current proposal is the current general fund base, which for bus is $59.8 million and per year, or $119.6 million biannually. And for rail, it's for Hiawatha Rail, it's $5.1 million annually, or $10.2 for the biennium. With respect to the new forecast, this first slide shows a statewide forecast. We'll have a following slide that shows the forecast as it affects the council transit and the regional transit fund. But this just shows you the history of the forecast. I think the point that I would like to make here is that we are hopefully at the bottom of the MBES trough, where we started out in 2003 with $605 million of annual statewide collections. That drops to $441 million in 2009. It's gone up slightly in 2010. It should be noted, as was noted in previous committees, that there was the Cash for Clunkers program during that time period. To what extent that had an impact on the forecast is anyone's guess. But the other thing that's shown here is that we have experienced forecast after forecast of overly optimistic projections on collections. The exception to that was the February 2009 forecast, but I believe previous to that there was something like 9 or 10 consecutive forecasts that were not realized in actual collections. And some of those dotted lines that you see on the downward heading portion of the line were previous forecasts to demonstrate that we're always hoping for better days, but the better days never quite came. I guess we're still, according to the current forecast, still hoping for better days, but you will forgive us for being somewhat skeptical as to whether the MBEST forecast will be actually realized in the end. That's a conditioned response to the forecast.
Mr. Koester, did the people doing the forecast, any ideas on why we've had such a long and sustained trend of declining new automobile sales, price, durability, financing, any thoughts at all?
Mr. Chair, we've met with the Department of Finance on a couple of occasions on this issue because, as you can understand, we have a lot of interest in having an accurate forecast, since the forecast is what you base your judgments
yes.
on. And they use Global Insights, a national forecasting model. Mm-hmm. I'm not certain to what degree Department of Finance or MMB now would have to speak to their exact model that they use and how they use Global Insights information. We're not sure how that's applied to local. Of course, MBEST also applies. Global Insights looks at new car markets. Global Insights, MBEST has both new car and used car mm-hmm. receipts. Global Insights looks at new car markets. It's a volatile sales area, you know, and I think that maybe it's a leading indicator of recession with car sales. I don't know that as a fact. But we do know it's very difficult to forecast. We do know that they've been consecutively overstating the MBEST that's come in, and we do know that that's hurt us because general fund appropriations have been based upon what they project to be MBEST collections.
Yes.
And it's a longer discussion. I spoke with MMB staff the other day, and we're going to have another discussion about how to handle this going forward. We're going to pursue whether there could be more sensitivity in the state forecasting. It's a very small piece of the state forecast. It's a very large piece of our revenues,
yes.
and that's the discussion that we have to have.
Thank you.
This next slide This slide shows the actual receipts and collections that have been forecasted for the Met Council, and the reason you don't see the downward trend that you saw in the previous forecast is that our share has been increasing on an annual basis. You can see at the low of the year shown at the bottom of the chart, the share of MBEST forecast collections that are distributed to regional transit services. And that has started out at 20.5%, and in 2010, the most recent year, it went up to 31%. This is all part of the phase-in plan that is contemplated by law. And if it were not for that, we'd be in much deeper trouble than we are today. But with the offsets of the increased share, we've been held relatively flat since 2003. If you consider flat revenues to be since 2003 to be positive news, I'd just say it could be worse news.
Mr. Koester, if you'd pause right there for a moment, we now have a quorum. So I'm going to call the meeting to order. House Transportation Policy Finance Committee is called to order. And we're going to adopt the minutes. The committee legislative assistant will note the roll as you come in the door. Can I have a motion to adopt the minutes of the last meeting? Representative Bogle moves them. Further discussion? Hearing none, let's vote. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Thank you. We've adopted the minutes. And we are officially in business. Representative Szymanski, you had a question for Mr. Koester on this point.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yes, I do. Sorry for arriving late and missing the first part of your presentation, but the question on the MVEST revenues, that is the sales tax on retail vehicle sales, both new and used vehicles, is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative, that's correct.
Okay. Mr. Follow Chairman, up. If I just follow up, also leased vehicles and...
Mr. Chair, Representative, I do not believe it includes leased vehicles.
There is a sales tax on leased vehicles, and Ms. Zewers perhaps can speak to that, how much it is, who collects it, and where it goes in the fund.
Mr. Chair and members, the leased vehicle sales tax is a portion of it is deposited in the Transit Assistance Fund, and that goes towards Greater Minnesota Transit. The leased vehicle sales tax brings in somewhere around $30 million per year. Most of those revenues go towards a tax provision that was enacted last session. And then the remaining funds are distributed 50% to county roads and 50% to Greater Minnesota Transit. And that amounts to, I believe, in the upcoming year, about $1 to $2 million for Greater Minnesota Transit.
Remind us of the tax provision, Ms. Azuers, that was enacted, that portion of that went to. That wasn't the Angel Credit. Was that the Angel Credit Fund? Okay.
Okay.
Follow up,
Mr. Chairman. And maybe I'm getting too deep into the details here, but on a motor vehicle title transfer between private parties, is there also a sales tax charge that's attributed into the MFS fund as well?
Perhaps Ms. Zuers could answer that one. The fees certainly on the transaction accrue to Department of Vehicle Service, DVS, but the sales tax that's self-reported?
Mr. Chair and Representative Szymanski, the fees from the title would go into the vehicle services operating account. The amount that is collected, the sales tax on the sale of the vehicle would go into the, a portion would go into the transit assistance fund because it would be motor vehicle sales tax.
Okay. Good questions. Thank you. Mr. Koistra.
Okay, Mr. Chair, also on this slide, I would point out that the black line that turns into the dotted line, which represents the current projections.
Okay.
It is the red line, dotted line you see there, that was the previous February forecast. It looks like a significant change on the out years, a less significant change on the near years, but it is significant to us. For example, the reason I'm comparing 2010 February 2010 to February 2011 is because February 2010 forecast was when the last decisions were made regarding our appropriations and our budget. Mm-hmm. And the change that is represented in a February to February forecast is a loss of $4.6 million in 2011, $25 million in 2012. This is all losses to the regional transit program, a little over $15 million in 2013. From our projections, about $16 million in 2014 and $11 million in 2015. The bottom line is, in total, over our five-year planning horizon, which is 2011 to 2015, we've lost from last February to this February in the forecast something in the neighborhood of $70 million or $14 or $15 million per year.
To be clear, you've lost that from the projections you thought you were going to get?
Right.
Okay. To be clear. Thank you.
And that's significant to us because we look at that revenues as part of our available revenue stream. We look out 4 to 5 years like you look out 4 to 5 years.
Sure.
And this becomes a significant loss to us.
Okay.
The near-term gain in from 9 to 10 was essentially offset by reductions in our general fund appropriations. Our general fund appropriations peaked in 2008 at about $98.8 million. In 2010, it was reduced to a little over $70 million per year. In 2011, it dropped to around $49 million per year, and that was in anticipation of increased motor vehicle sales tax receipts. And then part of that was a one-time reduction, and then that was brought back up to $65 million a year for 2012 and 2013 as our base. So we've gone from 98 million, 0.8 million down to 49 million, and then the real base stops at 65 million. But in all that movement, a lot of that movement had to do with anticipated MFS forecast again. And so you're hearing a message from me that we get real nervous about betting on the MFS forecast. We've come out significantly losers in this stock, yes. if you will.
Well, and Mr. Chair, the issue now is that we're fully phased in at that 36%, so there's no additional phase-in dollars there to help us with those fluctuations, which, as Mr. Koistra just said, have never quite met their expectations in the forecast. So,
yes.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Getting away from the new forecast and the change in the governor's rec, we'll begin with an overview of the response to the questions that you gave us. This is the council's mission. I'm not going to read the mission to you. You can see it there. I think you have the handout.
Mm-hmm.
What I want to emphasize from this slide is that the council's responsibilities go well beyond transit. Transit's your jurisdiction. But we have other areas of responsibility that relates to operations or planning of regional infrastructure in the metropolitan area, including wastewater services, parks, housing, affordable housing, and community development grants and other development redevelopment activities. With regard to the information request, we'd like to point out, as we did in our submission, that we received the information request received from the committee was really understandably geared towards state agencies. I think many agencies had received similar requests. The council, it should be pointed out, is a political subdivision of the state. In this case, it's more similar probably to a county than to a state agency. We operate on a calendar year basis. We use an independent accounting and procurement system. Like counties, we're audited by the state auditor. Just mentioned that our audit findings have come out quite clean over the past 5 years, and I think they're probably available to you on the state auditor's website, or we can certainly provide that information to you if you're interested. Our state appropriations are received as monthly grants, and this is combined with other revenues to support services. We receive MBEST as monthly dedicated revenues, and the actual amount of MBEST we receive is not what's in the forecast, but what's actually collected, a percentage of what's actually collected. While all questions did not apply directly to our situation, we really tried to do our best to fully respond to your questions and interpret them in the spirit that they were asked and provide the level of detail. If we've missed that mark, we'd like to know that, because we want to get that corrected. Just let us know and we'll get the information that you need. But we did our best to apply the questions to our situation. I should also point out that the information we're providing here does not include the suburban transit providers. I'm not sure if a separate request went to them, but we did not have that level of detail on their budgets that you were requesting of us. So our response that starts on this slide is really particular to council transit operations and does not include the six suburban transit providers' revenues or expenses that we also partner with for regional transit services. This is a slide that shows our revenues and expenses. Again, our fiscal year's calendar. This is information is unaudited 2010 calendar year information. It's a little different from what you've seen in the past, because the previous pie charts showed, again, region-wide revenues and expenses, and that included the suburban transit providers. This also does not include debt service costs.
Mr. Koistra, Representative Morrow has a question or comment.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I'm going to violate my own concern that I had the other day about the number of reports and questions we're asking different departments and the level of detail on everything from, I think it was air compressors, to every job position that we had.
It certainly wasn't the intention, but nonetheless, go
and
ahead.
So I'm with that in mind, I am still going to violate what I just expressed and ask Mr. Koistra. Mr. Koistra, I'm looking at the Greater Minnesota Transit Investment Plan, and I know you're not looking at that, but this is my question. On one of the pages of this, 1-15, if you needed to know, it breaks down Greater Minnesota Transit funding into four categories. Local, I can hand you this one, but Mr. Koistra, it's fairly straightforward. It breaks down Greater Minnesota Transit funding into local, federal, state general fund, and state MVEST. And what it shows from, say, 2008 to 2009 is that the federal, state general fund, and state MVEST all went down as percentage, and the local funding went up dramatically it went up 50% between 2008 and 2009 to pay for Greater Minnesota Transit. What I'm asking you for, I'm not asking for the answer today, is does Met Transit have a similar breakdown year to year of the relatively what is coming from the local, the federal, the state general fund, and the state MFEST. And I'll hand you this.
Mr. Chair, I'll respond very briefly. I think that we'll need to spend some time with Representative Morrow, and we'll talk to the folks from MnDOT and try to provide that similar type information, because I know we don't have that with us today,
right.
But we can certainly take a look at that and provide that to the committee.
Representative Morrow, could you remind us, where do we have that in our packets available to us here today? Or did you bring that from somewhere else?
Mr. Chair, actually, there was an electronic copy which we received, and I'm old school with a highlighter, so I asked for a hard copy of that particular report. And, Mr. Chair, the reason I'm asking is you're putting together your budget.
Yes.
If we could have something that gives us an apples-to-apples comparison, as best as can be done in this situation, of what the contribution sources are, the pots of money going to Met Transit and going to Greater Minnesota Transit.
That could be very helpful. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Mr. Chair, we'll be happy to provide that.
Thank you. Proceed.
Okay, Mr. Chair, going back to this slide, our MBEST is our greatest revenue source at 38%. The state general fund appropriations are at 17%. And I would just mention that we show state general fund appropriations as being dedicated entirely to council transit operations. That's how we manage the money. We could distribute it otherwise, but that to suburban transit providers, but that creates more complexity in our allocation system. So we retain the general fund appropriations. That impacts how much MBEST we distribute. So while it's the general fund appropriations are dedicated to council transit operations, if we were to receive a reduction to general fund appropriations, that reduction would be distributed across the region based upon how we then distribute MBEST. So I just want to be clear that where it falls in our budget doesn't mean it doesn't have a region-wide impact, a reduction, or an increase.
At some point, are you going to talk about your... pardon me, we've got a phone. I'm just going to make sure it's not mine here. At some point, are we going to have a discussion about the funding that you pass on to the... opt-outs and where that fits into your budget? Is that coming up here, or is this a good time to touch on that?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, this is probably a good time to touch on it because
Please.
Our presentation doesn't address that specifically.
All right. You mentioned there are no general fund dollars that are forwarded to you that are then in turn passed on to the opt-out providers. It's a percentage of the MBEST, as I'm understanding, correct?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. There is a... an amount that's of MBEST that's distributed by state law formula to the opt-out providers. And then there are two opt-out providers or two suburban transit providers who receive allocations in addition to that formula amount. To be qualified to receive additional allocations would mean that you would have to demonstrate that to continue current services you required those allocations. The situation really is that four of the six providers have enough reserves in place or are receiving enough through the formula, mm-hmm. or perhaps even more than enough through the formula to pay for the current service demands in their region. There are two, Southwest and MBTA, that require additional MBEST allocations.
It's a specific case, but I'm thinking about our friends in Scott County Transit are looking for a couple of spare buses for the duration of the flood event. Will that be provided? Do we have those laying around? Are there spares that can be pulled off the shelf and forwarded out there? Or if you can't talk about that, right, I might be a little ahead of you on that deal, but where would the funding come from that? Mr. Chetnin?
Well, Mr. Chair and members, we have talked about that. You and I talked about that briefly. I have talked to our folks in our Metropolitan Transportation Planning, and we will address that. I know that some of the opt-out providers do have some spare buses. Yeah. I know the folks at Southwest Transit have some buses that they use for Twins games that may be available since the Twins obviously don't start until April 8th. But we will make sure that there is an adequate response to make allow those people to get to work one way or another with the flooding that's going to go on down in Scott County. So I can't tell you exactly how that's going to work, but you can be assured that we'll make sure that it does work, and mm-hmm. we'll figure that out.
Thank you. And I have a hunch the operating and the operating costs will be picked up by Scott County Transit. And since you mentioned that the Twins opener was a week from yesterday,
yeah.
get a little snow to melt, but we'll work that out, I'm sure.
And, Mr. Chair, I'm not sure, again, about where the operating will come from. However, again, we will have to deal with it no matter what. We got to make sure people can get to where they need to go, and we'll address that.
Thank you, Mr. Shen. I appreciate it. Mr. Koister, please.
Okay, the final thing I'll mention on this slide is that if you look at MBEST and State General Fund, that represents about 55% of our revenues. we consider both at this point in time to be quite volatile, given the history of a general fund appropriation, given the history of the MVEST forecast. And then on the other side, the expense that we watch very closely is the fuel expense. I think it's been mentioned here before that a 10 cent increase in fuel has a cost of about $760,000 to us, because we use 7.6 million gallons of fuel per year. So a dollar increase is about $7.6 million eventually to our operations.
Before you come up that slide, Representative Hornstein has a question.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. You kind of anticipated, I think, my question, because it was about fuel, and you know, we're really at a point here where it's not just short-term volatility. I think this whole Middle East situation could drag out for a while. We have other pressures on gas prices, and so the question is, because it's 7% and rising of your expenses, what is the contingency? I mean, I think we have volatility, but I think the long-term trend is upward on gas prices. The hybrids, I know, help a lot, but how does the council anticipate addressing this issue that is way beyond your control but has such impact on the budget?
Mr. Chair, Representative Ornstein, there's a couple of ways that we address it. A short-term solution, I want to emphasize short-term because it was kind of misrepresented in the newspaper this morning, is that we purchase 90% of our gas on a price forwarding program, energy price forwarding program. I want to be clear, that doesn't mean that we don't pay the price of today. It means that the price of a day doesn't hit us until 18 to 20 months out on 90% of our fuel. And then 10% of our fuel is under current pricing mechanism. So that gives us, we do this price forwarding not as as a investment in fuel oil futures, but as budget certainty. So it gives us gives us 18 months of stability on 90% of our fuel costs that we eventually have to pay later on. The other direction, if fuel goes the other direction, we're paying more than the current pricing. So that gives us short-term stability. On the long term, I know that Mr. Lamb, who is the general manager for Met Transit, could speak better to this, but there's been a lot of initiatives to become more efficient in our routing. There's been a lot of purchase of hybrid buses that have had a significant impact on our fuel usage. I believe that between 2009 and 2010, there was something like 800,000 more rides given, and our fuel usage was 600,000 gallons less. That just is a nice number representation of how we're becoming more efficient. But as with you and your budget, there is low-hanging fruit, and then you run out of low-hanging fruit. So we've looked at the recent fuel prices in our planning, because we try to plan through 2015, and we've worked with the person who is in charge of our price forward program, and we're looking at perhaps up to $40-45 million of additional cost that we were not planning on through 2015. It's a significant problem for us. The good news is we have 18 months of stability. The bad news is we pay eventually.
Thank you.
Follow up? Good. Representative Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Actually, you answered the bulk of my question. Could it or would it be prudent, in fact, I guess, I figured you probably were buying in a price forward or bulk situation in some way so you could weather this current storm, but eventually that's going to hit you. Would it be conceivable that we need to take a look at passenger fare prices to think about how we would plan for that $46 million deficit?
Mr. Chair, Representative, certainly two interventions other than cost reductions, which we've been working on over the past several years, would be to either reduce service or increase fares. Increasing fares has an impact on ridership, so it's not a one-for-one return. We're hoping not to have to do that. There are some fares that increase people who can afford it the least. There are other targeted fare increases that there may be a better a greater ability to pay. Those are all considerations. Impact on the individual ability to get to work, because much of our ridership is people going to and from work. Impact on our ridership as a whole and what that does to our total fare collections. All those things are on the table when we're facing these kinds of situations. One of the reasons the governor took away the reduction he had originally proposed in light of the MBEST change was to say, I don't want to be the cause of a fare increase in the budget. I don't want the state to be a cause of that. Now, you know, fuel prices are an independent factor that neither you nor the governor have control over.
Follow up?
Just a hypothetical crystal ball. If you were to look at prices continuing, I mean, there doesn't seem to be a resolution to it until we change our policies on how we explore and secure energy at home. Crystal ball, you think that a fare hike is probable?
Mr. Koester, if you wish.
Mr. Chair, I don't even want to speculate on it at this point. It depends on what our general fund appropriation is. It depends on where fuel prices go. It depends on how the MFEST forecast performs. We have so many areas that have volatility and risk to it that I don't think it would be responsible for me to suggest this is going to happen or this isn't going to happen. That creates a response that on a hypothetical that probably isn't good to create.
Representative Szymanski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Koester, do we have access to further data regarding the graphs that we see on the screen here today?
Mr. Koester, Mr.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, I think there were 10 years of more line item expense provided yesterday to you on that yesterday.
In our handoff.
And again, there's a lot of detail there. We'd be happy to sit down with you or others to go through that, but it's a lot. It's 30 pages, I believe, of line item.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Proceed. Okay, now I'm going to start managing your clock a little bit because you got
thank you, Mr. Chair.
23 minutes here.
Okay, Mr. Chair, this shows the change in our budget from 2002 to 2011. The total change in our operating budget, and this again is for Council Transit, doesn't include the suburban transit providers, is just under 50%. During this period of time, we've added North Star, Hiawatha, we've added services along the 35W corridor. We've added services to Forest Lake that began at the time the bridge collapsed. And then there's other communities that there's been some small changes in service provision to. Also during this time, our ridership has increased by about 18% in total. Cost increases have not been the result of adding staff. Staff hours have remained essentially flat. We've actually shown a reduction of 25 FTEs even after adding the services that I mentioned. New FTE demands by rail have been absorbed through FTE reductions in bus. If you exclude rail service and look at bus only, then the 10-year operating budget increase is about $80 million or 32.5%, which is less than inflation during that time, which was the state and local government price deflator, I believe, was 40.4% during that time. It is a footnote on the slide. Full-time equivalents in bus only have gone down 260, or about nearly 9.5%. Mm-hmm. People might say, well, the reduction in the bus full-time equivalents is because rail has taken over the ridership, and that's not borne out by the facts either. Bus ridership has remained relatively flat. So really the story is, overall, FTEs have been relatively flat. Ridership is up 18%. Bus ridership is flat. Most of the ridership growth is in rail. The rail additional effort by FTEs has been essentially offset by bus FTE reduction. Bus FTE reduction is really the result, I think, is constantly trying to provide a more efficient service through route technology that we use, the HASIS program, and so forth. So there are some good stories here. Other factors in looking at the change of 50%. Again, the government implicit price deflator during that time was 40.4%. I don't know if that's the perfect price deflator. Yeah, I know that government price deflator does lean more heavily towards wages, and certainly a greater part of our budget is wages, so it might be applicable. But we've also, as I mentioned, added new service, Hiawatha, North Star, and some bus operations. Fuel during this period of time went up 229%. Our fuel cost increase, while fuel costs overall went up 229%, our fuel cost increase went up only 124%, and that's in part for the reasons we've already discussed, with the use of hybrid buses, fuel-forward pricing, other efficient development of more efficient routes and so forth. Healthcare cost increases went up 115% during this time. Bus parts went up 69%. If you look at fuel costs, healthcare, and bus parts in 2002, at the beginning of this time frame, they represented just under 7% of our total costs. In terms of, but they represent about 30% of our total increase. It's probably not too different a story of any other business that relies, that is a heavy fuel user and provides health care to their employees. It's those are the two areas that are driving our costs. There was a question about the impact of a general fund reduction. This just shows you the calculation that 15% reduction on bus operating would be about $9 million. 20% would be about $12 million per year on the base. This isn't telling you a lot more than what you couldn't do with your own calculator. Our budget priorities would be to maintain the American Disability Act compliance requirements that is fulfilled to a great extent through Metro Mobility. So we have some Metro Mobility obligations that are regulated that we have to fulfill. Our other priority is to preserve existing service. And that has been our priority all along. We've been trying to preserve existing service and then meet certain commitments that this body has made along with previous legislatures on terms of starting Hiawatha, North Star, and the 35W corridor work. So that would continue to be our priority. Again, we have so many moving parts, it's very difficult to say what would be the specific impact of a general fund reduction without knowing where we're at with fuel pricing, where we're at with the MBS piece.
Mr. Koistra, the Metro Mobility component, when we're looking at this slide, is that rolled into the bus operating numbers we see here? In fact, on the previous slides, too.
Yes.
Metro Mobility is rolled into the bus operating expenses.
That's correct.
Okay. Members, before you proceed, we're fortunate and privileged to have with us today, I guess a better word, a St. Louis Park ninth grade high school class is going to come and observe us. It's a transportation budget meeting. It won't exactly be scintillating if I do this right, but you're certainly welcome to sit here and enjoy, and welcome. We're glad you're here today. Okay, questions on the previous slide before we... Mr. Koistra, please proceed.
Mr. Chair, I'll try to make this more exciting.
Yeah. Yeah, the kids are watching. Jazz it up a little bit. Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, I do have a question before he moves on.
Representative Leidiger, question. Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm actually going to go back a couple of slides on the increased ridership. Did we, from the terminals to the airport, we had, give passengers a free ride there. Is that included in that increased ridership number, and to what degree? Please,
Mr. Shatner, you have someone who can speak
Mr.
to that?
Chair and Representative, yes, they are included. I can certainly have Mr. Lamb come up and speak to that if you would like.
If you would, briefly, and refresh our memory on what the arrangement is with our friends at the airport there. Mr. Lamb, did you catch the question? Can you speak to the...
Yes, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Brian Lamb, General Manager for Metro Transit. Right now, I believe the number's in the neighborhood of 1.5 million rides between the two terminals. That is in lieu of the operating fares. As you remember, Mr. Chair, that MAC had contributed to the construction of the tunnel underneath the airport, and that was an agreement that we made that we would then have a free fare zone so that people could access both terminals using light rail, which is really the only expedient way to connect those two terminals.
Okay.
So
follow up.
So I would. So what? To what degree is that ridership change this total ridership figure of 18%?
Well, Mr. Lamb, our representative, do you say 1.7 million per year?
Mr. Chair, we will get back with this specific number. It's in that general number.
It's in this data that you've given?
I'm not sure we have that broken out in that data, but I will follow up and make sure you get the exact number. But you could take whatever that number that we will provide, which is in the neighborhood of that 1.7, off of that gross total of 84.5, if that's what you were attempting to.
Well,
Mr. Leidinger, Representative Leidinger?
It just seems skewed a little bit. I want to just get a more realistic figure.
Well, certainly. Good. Yeah, you can email that over. That'd be sufficient.
That'd be great.
Mr. Chair, we will do so.
Appreciate it. Thank you for your information. Mr. Koyster, please.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, we've covered much of the information on the FTE change. This is a greater breakdown of the FTE change. It starts off with Metro Transit, which is primarily the bus and rail services. It breaks that out by the reductions by bus and by rail. It breaks bus further down. Mm-hmm. You can see that the reductions in FTEs are pretty much across the board, with the exception of public safety interests. We have increased FTEs during this time of the police program at Met Transit. But other than that, all areas received some reduction in FTEs. In fact, the professional, technical, and managerial area received the greatest percent reduction of 17% at that time. All the rail FTEs are new, because rail service had not begun in 2002. And then Metropolitan Transportation Services, which oversees planning and metro mobility and contracted bus services, Van Go, Dial-A-Ride, those sorts of programs, also saw a reduction of about 9 FTEs, or 20% of the professional technical managerial area. So it just gives you a breakdown of an overview we've already given you.
Mr. Koyster, the police officer, are they fully sworn peace officers? Officers of the court?
Mr. Chair, I'm told that they are, yes.
Good, thank you. Good to know. Please, proceed. There we go.
This is the vehicle this is the vehicle page that shows what our revenue vehicles are from total revenue vehicles and support vehicles. We have 1,445 total revenue vehicles. We have 197 support vehicles. Most of the support vehicles include cars and vans for light rail transit system maintenance, where we have to drive out to provide the maintenance services. It includes the transit police cars that are in those vehicles. It includes transit police supervision. Includes cars necessary for people to go out and do fare box repair, and then cars that are vehicles that are required to do bus and facilities maintenance services as well.
A question on your twin peaks of service, morning and afternoon. How many buses do we have on the street in the morning rush and the evening rush, about?
Mr. Chair and members, we have roughly 750 buses during those peak periods out on the street.
Okay,
and then that drops significantly during the off-peak times and then overnight.
Okay. Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I know, I think in the earlier presentation you did mention this, but in light of our, and a couple weeks ago, your earlier presentation, but in light of our conversation about high gas prices, I had just wanted you to refresh our memory about how many of these 1,358 buses are hybrids, how many more are you projected to purchase, and is there a way to accelerate the purchase of these buses? Because again, I think this whole gas cost issue is not going away, and in fact I think it could get worse as time goes on.
Mr. Lamb, can you speak to that? And
yeah.
Why don't you just give us a very brief overview of what we mean when we're talking hybrid, because I know we do a biofuel blend, and we got some gas, diesel, and so on. talk to us about what that's
Mr.
all about.
Chair, there are several elements that are part of our fleet plan and our fuel reduction plan. Representative Hornstein's question, right now we have 97 hybrids in the Metro Transit fleet. The hybrid buses average about 20 to 25% better fuel efficiency than their all-diesel alternatives. And are one of the big reasons why Mr. Koister's earlier point about that we ran more miles on less gas or less fuel last year because of that fuel efficiency. Overall, 40-foot vehicles are the new big bus in this generation are getting better fuel efficiency than their counterparts that we are retiring. And so that is one big element of what we want to stay on top of a regular retirement plan so we get better fuel efficiency with our new vehicles. Secondly, the question regarding our use of biodiesel. That is, first of all, a state requirement, so we have it used for all of our diesel vehicles use biodiesel. We have experimented with as much as 20% biodiesel, and we have done so very successfully in the summer months, but biodiesel has a gelling element that we still are concerned about, and so we bring it down in the winter months. The last few years, though, the cost per gallon on biodiesel is not as advantageous for us to go above the state mandate. So we've been more or less operating at between 5 and 10% of biodiesel content on all of the Metro Transit buses.
When you talk hybrid, is there a dual fuel capacity there? What is the other portion of the fuel?
Mr. Chair, hybrid. I'm sorry.
When we talk about hybrid vehicles, what are the fuel sources for hybrid vehicles?
The fuel sources are, essentially, it's a smaller diesel engine that's about the size of a Dodge Ram, but it runs at a continual RPMs, and it's augmented by electrical energy that is coming from when you put on the brakes, there's a lot of energy that's captured, and then that is provides the kind of additional less cost-effective energy that you need when you are, for instance, accelerating. And so it is a growing area in terms of all transit vehicles in terms of this hybrid use of hybrid electric.
So we're capturing brake energy, which usually is wasted to heat, and storing it in a way that we can expend it when we're accelerating from a stop then.
Yes.
Outstanding. It sounds like a field trip after we get done with this.
Mr. Chair, we'd invite you to do that, and also I will say that Metro Transit is in the lead on some next generation applications of offloading things from the engine and onto an all electrical system, and we'd be happy to show the committee that as well.
We're intrigued to see it. To this point, Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one quick last follow-up on this item, and I think you're absolutely right, Mr. Chairman. I think this is just a win-win-win kind of proposition. So to that issue, is there a plan to perhaps accelerate the purchasing of hybrids? And I know that annually or at least once per biennium, and not annually, there is a Metropolitan Council capital bill. Representative Abrams carried it when, you know, my early years in the minority, and then I carried it a couple of times. Is that an opportunity to potentially accelerate the purchase of hybrid buses?
Mr. Chair,
Mr. Lamb,
Representative Hornstein, to your question, that number is one that we change actually year to year based on our capital budget outlook, and so it is more expensive to buy hybrid buses than our standard diesel buses, and so we are trying to just maintain our current level of fleet replacement, and sometimes the delta happens to be in how many future hybrids. Now, I will say that our optimum number is around half of our fleet, because as I said, the regenerative braking is more applicable and more cost effective on local uses than they are if you would kind of imagine express bus uses. Yeah. So not every bus is ripe for hybrid use. I also want to emphasize that Metro Mobility also has experimented in using some hybrid vehicles use as well. And while I'm up here, Mr. Chair, let me clarify that 750 that we talked about during the peak, was only including the Metro Transit number. When you include some of the other council contracted services and Metro mobility services, that number during the peak hour raises, and we'll get that number to the committee.
Good. Thank you. Representative Benson, and I'm going to go by my watch, Mr. Shetton. It says you have 9 minutes left rather than that one up there. So,
yes.
Mr. Benson.
It seems we're probably getting into the weeds a little bit more than we thought, and I trust that you are looking at the technologies that make the most sense.
Absolutely.
But one that we haven't talked about yet, and it seems the probably the least volatile in terms of energy sources, is natural gas. And I just wondered if you could comment at all on that technology, because if we look at operating expenses, they far outweigh what the cost of the bus is going to be at some point. That's my assumption, at least, because you had a 13-year, if I remember right, life cycle on these buses, something like that?
Yeah, right around 12.
12, okay. Does natural gas make sense?
Mr. Chair, I'm going to defer one more time to Mr. Lamb.
All right.
Okay. I'm not going to let him leave until we're off the slide.
Mr. Chair,
Mr. Lamb.
Representative, we have just completed an analysis on natural gas buses vis-a-vis diesel buses. We'd be happy to provide the committee with that analysis. The long term is that the volatility of prices is one of the things that's really hard to factor for certain. But in our northern climate, with the safety precautions that you need to build into the facilities or retrofit facilities, there's a real front end cost associated with converting to natural gas, and then you've got to figure out over a 13-year program how you would make those building conversions pay off when you essentially are only replacing 1/13 of your fleet in any given year. Regardless, Mr. Chair, we can provide the staff analysis on the natural gas.
I'm going to ask that you hold that off for our field trip. Members, one of the field trip we're going to take on Friday that got postponed by leadership was kind of around this point. We will be revisiting the issue. I think there's some fascinating things for us to learn about on that. You okay, Representative Benson? And if you'd hold that, Mr. Lamb, don't go away, because Representative Murray and then Representative Morrow has a question. Representative Murray.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My question is, do we have an idea of what we're saving in fuel cost or the like by using the hybrid buses versus the old buses? And then I'd have a follow-up. But go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, we do. We believe we track that. In fact, we track it by different model years. And we have been tracking between 20 and 25% by model year savings compared to standard diesel. So rough terms are we're about a 40-foot bus gets about 4.2 miles per gallon. And a hybrid bus gets a little better than 5 miles per gallon.
Okay, thank you. And then, Mr. Right. Chairman, a follow-up would be, what are the cost differentials between the old bus and a hybrid bus, just so?
Capital cost?
Capital cost, yes.
Roughly. Mr. Chair, Representative, right now the capital cost, although it's dropping a little bit, is about $180,000 per vehicle for a hybrid bus.
Versus, Mr. Chairman.
Versus what for a standard bus, Mr.
Oh, Lamb? I'm sorry. I meant that was the delta difference. The gross cost for a standard 40-foot vehicle is about $380,000 to $400,000, and it's almost
Thank you.
560-ish. Thank you. Representative Morrow.
Just a quick observation, Mr. Chair, especially to my friends across the way here, that we do enjoy the economic benefits of biodiesel down in our districts. And I know I'm not going to ask Met Council or Met Transit to calculate the benefit of keeping some of that money in state.
Noted, Representative Morrow. Thank you. Okay, Mr. Lamb, rather than get up and leave, why don't we ask Mr. because that seems to attract more questions when you go away. Mr. Koistra. Can you proceed without Mr. Shetton sitting by your side? There you go.
Mr. Chair, I promise to do more homework on rolling stock before my next presentation. I apologize. As far as other information, I can kind of wrap it up here. There was a question about chargebacks to the state. We don't have chargebacks in the state.
Certainly.
We do have an FDA-approved A87 plan, cost allocation plan. We've provided that to the committee. We have no carry-forward requests. Our general fund, again, is received as a grant. We received that in Monthly increments. Okay. MVEST, it's actual collections. Mm-hmm. We have not, another question was our authority transfer mm-hmm. livable communities funds. We were asked to commit to using that as a last resort. We have honored that commitment, and we have not transferred any livable communities funds or highway right-of-way acquisition loan funds to the transit operations. There are two or three pending lawsuits that are related to Central Corridor. You're probably aware of those. They're generally quite publicized. There's the MPR lawsuit. There's a lawsuit along the Rondo neighborhood related to NAACP. And there's also, I believe, one other lawsuit that is related to condemnation. That's right, condemnation proceedings.
Actually, Mr. Lamb, you can go.
Yeah, right.
And then we don't engage in rulemaking activity, and that brings me to the end, or about right on time, I hope.
Outstanding. Any follow-up brief questions or brief comments before we wrap up this segment? Members, Mr. Shetland, thank you. Mr. Lamb, thank you for your information and being a good sport. And Mr. Koistra, appreciate it. Members, in your packet is some other information that has a little more detail to the presentation we were just made here. So if you got more questions on that, drill down there. Or we'll, I'm sure Mr. Shetland would be happy to come and see us and respond to questions if necessary. Mr. Morrow, Representative Morrow, do you want this?
Thank you very much.
Good. Members will have, I think it's Scott Peterson, Mr. Peterson from MnDOT come back, and they have a little more budget enlightenment to do for us. In your packet, members, you have the printout of the material that Mr. Peterson is going to present.
I got it.
Just a moment. Peterson, you ready to go?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I believe we're ready. We got the
welcome back
technology figured out. Thank you. And just to remind the committee, we're here to finish up the presentation of financial information that we began last week. This information was developed in response to a letter from the committee. And again, we are just in time information as it was last time. We spent the time between last Wednesday and today trying to put all this information together, and unfortunately we don't have a nice PowerPoint presentation like the Met Council has, so I hope you will forgive us for that, but I hope it is a little bit easier for you to follow us this afternoon than it was last Wednesday. We provided paper copies, I believe, for everyone so we can all follow along and in order, and so we'll just take the information in the order in which it appears in your handout. So the first set of information is a response to the request for information on our indirect cost fund, and this is basically to reimburse the state for the cost of administering programs that are funded by federal funds. And there are two components to that. One is for the agency itself, and one is to pay for services that are provided for these programs by other agencies. So if you flip over to the backside of the front page, you'll see that the indirect cost rate for July 1st, 2009 to June 30th, 2012 was 13.03%, and 10.85% of that is for the for MnDOT, and 2.18% of that was for the other agency cost reimbursement. Okay. And this document that you see here is the actual agreement that we complete with FHWA to set that rate for the agency. And then if you keep flipping to the back side of the following page, you can see again some more detail on how that's calculated. Certain costs that MnDOT incurs are eligible to be included in this indirect cost rate calculation. Others are not, and the details of how that's calculated is laid out there. And then if you turn to the next page where you see this table of categories and costs, if you go over to the right-hand side and down to about the fourth from the bottom of that table of numbers there, you see it says agency slash statewide indirect cost $6,239,800. Mm-hmm. And so that is the amount that we paid in those indirect costs in 2008.
Now, Mr. Peterson, to be clear, as I understand, this is an agreement with the federal government. So when they route monies to us through MnDOT, this much money, or this percentage, can be withheld by the office for administering the programs and taking care of things. This is the portion of the money that doesn't actually turn into concrete or asphalt somewhere. Is that a rough understanding of what this does?
Mr. Chairman, that is correct. I think it's worth noting that MnDOT does not request an indirect cost reimbursement from the Federal Highway Administration for highway projects, though. This is for other programs that are funded by FHWA. So we made that decision a while back just so we could put all of our highway program funds into concrete.
Okay. Thank you.
Then there are some other questions, if we can stay on that page for a minute, related to that, have to do with salaries and benefits, equipment, out-of-state travel, in-state travel, communications, and overtime. And in that, staying at that same table on the right-hand side of the sheet there, up in the compensation grouping at the top, you'll see where it says overtime and premium, $11,603,000. Mm-hmm. Then if you go about a third of the way down through that next set of numbers, you'll see communications is $3,548,400. Travel is $3,734,000. Of that amount, about $320,000 was for out-of-state travel, and the rest is for in-state travel. Mm-hmm. And then going down to the line right above the agency statewide indirect costs, you'll see that in that year, MnDOT spent $21,773,000 on equipment.
Equipment being like office equipment and engineering equipment, computer equipment, and so on?
Mr. Chairman, this would also be our trucks and and road construction maintenance equipment as well. Mm-hmm. And then you also requested, Mr. Chairman, some information on our indirect cost rate for the past 10 years, and so on the back side of that page we were just looking at, you will see those rates. And those rates are set for 3 years, and so you'll see the periods to which they apply there.
Thank you.
So the next set of information has to do with appropriation carryforwards, and there are several different provisions of law that allow us to carry forward appropriations from one fiscal year to the next. And if you go down towards the bottom of this page, you'll see they're listed there for you. One has to do with airport development and assistance funding, mm-hmm. and which is available for 5 years after the appropriation. Local road appropriations are regularly carried forward to future fiscal years. This has to do with a couple things. One is the state aid funds are distributed on a calendar year basis, and they're appropriated on a on a fiscal year basis, and so we're always a little bit out of sync there. So at the beginning of every calendar year, the commissioner issues an order as specified in law to inform the committee, the legislature on how the money will be distributed in that subsequent calendar year, and any other information relative to spending. And so that's one part of it. The other part is the construction apportionments that go to local governments from their share of the state aid distribution do not go out in a one-time distribution as the maintenance funds do, but are distributed on an as-needed basis for construction costs. So that can carry on for more than 1 year. If a project isn't ready to go in the year it was originally expected to be funded, or if the project itself is constructed over more than one calendar year.
Okay.
The next one is appropriations for highway construction. Again, we have many construction projects that require more than 1 year to construct, and so we have authority to carry over the appropriations to be used for those projects until that project is completed. The fourth one, appropriations for capital projects. This has to do with projects funded with bond funds. The department does get regular bond appropriations for, in particular, local bridges, which is a program that's regularly funded, and so these appropriations are carried forward as needed to fund those projects. Statutory appropriations, we covered last time a set of accounts in the special revenue funds, which are basically from dedicated receipts for work that the MnDOT does for local governments or for reimbursements for damage to our roads, and we have statutory authority to spend that money when we receive it.
Mr. Peterson.
Yes, sir.
Mr. Representative Benson, question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Three, I guess, primarily. How much unspent bond money do we still have? I mean, we're carrying forward quite a bit, but I mean, if we were to release all that bond money to get projects completed so we could, you know, add a few bucks to the economy, what are we talking about? How much money's in there?
Mr. Peterson, can you speak to that, or Mr. Spallman? Either one.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Benson, I know we just supplied that information to Representative Howes, but I don't recall the numbers, but we'll be glad
to provide
it to you.
Can you get that for me? Sure. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Mm-hmm. Going to number six there in that list, then we received some money from the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act in 2009, and that money was appropriated to MnDOT until expended, so it carried over fiscal years and to allow us to use all those funds in a timely manner. A unique carryover in number seven there was in 2009 in the biennial appropriations bill, there was some authority included in that bill that allowed MnDOT to carry over unencumbered operating balances from trunk highway appropriations from fiscal year 2009. So we carried over about $50 million of those appropriations into fiscal year 2010 and 2011. And then number eight there permits carrying forward non-grant balances from the first year of the biennium to the second year, which is a pretty standard practice among all state agencies.
Kind of related to this, Mr. Peterson, but we didn't specifically ask for it, was there's been some discussion about the earmarks that are kind of lost out there in the bushes. Maybe a program has expired or was never completed or started, and there's congressional appropriations out there. Off the top of your head, and I know this wasn't part of the question, do you know about where we're at with that investigation?
Mr. Chairman, we did some research on that, and I think provided some information to the legislature on that topic. But I don't remember what that number is again off the top of my head.
We'll deal with that another day.
But we'd be glad to provide that.
And I know it's nothing we can fix. We should just be aware of it because it's actually a congressional problem. Apparently, as I understand it, they're the ones that actually need to change the law to turn the money loose, if I'm not mistaken. So,
Mr. Chairman, that's my understanding as well.
Okay.
And then after that page that we were just discussing, then you'll see the specific language that appeared in the reference to bills that provide the specific legal authority for those appropriation carry forward, in addition to Statute 16A.28, which also provides some of that authority.
Okay.
So if there are no questions about that, we'll move on to the when it changes in organizational structure and FTE counts. And behind this page, there are several iterations of org charts from the Department of Transportation from the current back to 2002, so covering now three different administrations. And I'm not going to take the time to go through all those, Mr. Chairman, unless there's a question or particular interest there. But the current one is actually the one right copied to the back of this one, and then they go back. They start with the one that from 2002 and then work again forward to the most recent one after this one.
You've now identified where your name is on the chart. Good. Thank you, Mr. Mr. Peterson. Okay, this the next one, the blue one is our current one.
That's
current
correct,
org
Mr.
chart.
Chairman, yeah.
The next one, looking for a year. Oh, here we go.
That's
2002. I see the dates now. Thank you. Okay.
So, that, Mr. Chairman, that was from the Ventura administration, and then subsequent ones that were enacted when Lieutenant Governor Molnau was the commissioner, and then after the current Commissioner Sorrell was appointed.
Okay.
And on the back side of that last org chart is some information on the number of employees at MnDOT from fiscal year 2 through fiscal year, well, up to February of 2011.
Yes.
So you can see in fiscal year 2002, there were 5,417 employees at MnDOT, and that's bounced around a fair amount. And as of February 2011, we are at 4,895 employees.
Thank you. This is a good look. I appreciate that. Severed attorneys. Can you give us a real definition? Keep our minds from running off and what that might mean?
Mr. Chairman, I actually cannot do that. We had our HR director here a minute ago to answer questions of that nature, but I don't see him in the audience.
Mr. Peterson, it's okay. We'll just
we'd be happy to provide that information.
It was just an interesting mental image. You could just shoot us an email. It'd be great. So.
Okay, we'll be happy to do that. And then the facing page there shows similar information, but on an FTE basis. Again, just for members' information, the first table there shows actual number of employees, and the second one is our FTE equivalents, which is basically the total number of hours worked at the department during the year divided by 2,080, or the equivalent of a full-time employee. And again, you'll see that that number has moved around quite a bit. Fiscal year 03, 5,240 basically employees, and then at the end of fiscal year 10, we're at 4,969.
The snowplow drivers, they'd be in the trunk highway grouping?
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
Well, Mr. Peterson, just pass on behalf of the committee to them a pat on the back for a job well done in an unusually snowy year, including some snow events that were going on during rush hour. I think they did a pretty commendable job. So,
Mr. Chairman, I'll be happy to do that. They'll be pleased to know that their dedication is
they're appreciated.
Is appreciated. And if there are no questions, then we'll...
To this point, members, anything? I'm sure as we dwell on it and ponder it, there'll be more, but we can contact you. Representative Szymanski does have a question.
I tweak my curiosity. Mr. Peterson, on the slide, the bargaining units and so forth, here. In the middle of that grouping, there's a group called Insufficient Work Time Unrepresented. What are those? Are those overflow staff, or what are we looking at there?
Mr. Peterson, can you speak to that?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Representative Szymanski, my understanding is that those are workers who were not employed for enough hours in order to qualify for representation by one of the bargaining units.
All right.
Would that include, like, the interns and things like that, do you suppose?
I think I'm I'm getting some head nods, Mr. Chairman, that they would be included in that category. And it could be. We do hire, just again for the committee's information, we do hire temporary employees, especially in the wintertime, to help us with the snow plowing operations.
Representative Benson.
Would it also be, do you have in your contracts an unrepresentative probation period? They have to go through that period prior to becoming represented, or no?
Mr. Peterson?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Representative Benson, yes, they do. They vary it by bargaining unit. I don't know the specific terms for all of them, but I know for MAPE, for example, it's 6 months probationary period, and for the manager's plan, it's a year.
Okay. Follow up. Representative Benson, follow up.
Yeah. There is a bill working its way through committees that looks at a 15% reduction in state employees. Now, I realize that, you know, it's not law or anything like that of that nature, but have you thought about cuts and what it might mean for you folks in terms of being able to manage your workload and the like if you were to look at efficiency gains?
Mr. Peterson?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Benson, we have not really spent a lot of time thinking about that yet, but we have started that process.
How is your, at the agency next door, what we call the bubble, I guess, there's a bunch of us 50-somethings out there that are working our way through the system. Have you identified a cross-section of what your retirements might look like over the next 5 to 7 years and what that might mean for staffing the agency? I mean, I know you can do more engineering work with powerful computers and so on, but snowplows still pretty much need a driver in the cab and so on and so forth. Can you give us a brief discussion about that, or is that coming up in the presentation here?
Mr. Chairman, I know that we have looked at that, and I don't know the exact numbers offhand. I haven't been involved in those conversations lately, but the demographics of our workforce does trend towards the bubble, as you put it, the demographic that I'm in, the people that are a little longer in the career. I'm we can get you some numbers on that. The age of the workforce, do you have any
demographic of the workforce? Because this is recorded and are people listening at home on the internet.
Thanks,
so. So you identify yourself for the record, that'd be great, too.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Eric Davis. I'm the Human Resources Director for the Minnesota Department of Transportation. Our average age is just about 47 years of age. Post the early retirement incentive that this body authorized last year, it'll drop just about 1 year of age to about 46 years of age on average per employee.
Okay, spread over about 4,900 employees, that half of them are older than 47 and half are younger.
Yes, sir. It's probably skewed even more so to the closer to 60 than 40.
Well, members, you probably get a mental image then of kind of how that graph would look.
We have. Okay. My understanding is a question about the planning we've done or analysis of retirement eligible employees and planning we've done to replace that workforce. With the incentive, the early retirement incentive, we offered 415 of our employees the opportunity to retire early with plans to fill behind in some cases in different kinds of classifications, different sorts of skill sets, knowledge, skills, and abilities for those folks. In about 360 or so of those instances. Long range, we know we're vulnerable to retirement. About 20% of our workforce is going to be vulnerable or eligible for retirement, so we see ourselves as vulnerable there.
20% over what window of time?
I see it extended over the next 4, 5, 6 years.
Okay.
It's just the baby boom generation that we're all acquainted with that is exiting over that time frame.
Mm-hmm. I'm thinking when we offer early retirement, people take it, but then programs of work come through. Are they eligible to be hired back on a contract basis? Do we do that at all? Or
under the current legislation prohibits us from rehiring those individuals either through as a consultant or in any other employment capacity for a period of 3 years.
Understood. Thank you. Further questions or comments? Thank you, Mr. Davis. Appreciate
Thank you,
it.
Sir.
Okay, Mr. Peterson.
Yes, sir. Mr. Chairman, moving on to the agency goals and mission statement, that's listed in its entirety. I think here on this page, and unless there are some questions, I won't go through that. Then there was also a question about performance measures, and I'll get to that information in just a minute. But there's also a question about changes made at MnDOT after the in response to a legislative auditor's report that followed the collapse of the 35W bridge. And there's some description on this page of some of the changes that occurred. And we also just filed a report with the legislature on that very topic, and that the location where that report can be found is listed here too. So if the committee is interested in more detailed information, they can refer to that. And of course, we'd be happy to answer any questions beyond that if they have that. But in the paragraph right above that, the web address, starting in about the third line there, it says bridge maintenance has increased by about 50% since August of 2007, or 55 positions. We've developed some standard methods for reporting maintenance needs from bridge inspections and for prioritizing follow-up maintenance. And then we've developed new performance measures to report progress in completing preventive maintenance activities and high-priority reactive maintenance items, and again, to make sure that we're more systematic in tracking the work that needs to be done on these bridges and making sure it gets done in a timely fashion.
Okay.
And if you flip over the page, you'll see what we call our results scorecard, which is kind of a summary of the performance measures that the department uses to guide its investment decision making. And it covers kind of all the priority activity areas that the department has, starting with traveler safety. Just kind of orient members to the document itself. On the left-hand side is a description of the measure, the yellow symbols that follow that, moving to the right, indicate and how well that we're doing in terms of achieving our performance target. So green means that we are achieving it. Yellow means that we're in the neighborhood, but perhaps not trending the right way. And red means that we have work to do in order to achieve our measure. You see in the safety area in particular, we're doing pretty well. If you, again, look at that graph that is there, again, moving to the right, you'll see the trend line. And right next to that, you'll see the word better written vertically and an arrow. And that's to orient the user of the material here to which direction we are trying to move the trend line, because sometimes it's not immediately obvious. So in this case, we're trying to drive the line towards a lower number, and so that's what that means. And then there's a brief analysis or description of what's happening in that area.
Representative Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Who performs the audits for you about whether or not you're meeting these measurements?
Mr. Peterson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Benson, this information is basically self-reported. To my knowledge, this information has not been audited. I'm just looking quickly to see.
Mr. Peterson, you have a desk in-house that compiles these numbers and tracks this information down, don't you?
Mr. Chairman, we have a unit within the department that works with different activity areas within the department to develop the performance measures and target levels, and then identifies a data source or a data acquisition method in order to determine how well we're doing to achieve the goal. But the data itself is basically either pulled from existing systems or reported in some fashion by the area that's responsible for the work.
Understood. Thank you.
And so unless the committee is interested in any of this information, I don't want to necessarily waste their time going through all of this.
Fascinating discussion, though.
You know, one thing that might be of interest are the two red symbols down there, pavement ride. We look at it, both the principal arterials and non-principal arterials, and I think that the committee is probably aware that we do have some issues with our pavement quality, and we plan to seriously make some investments in those to try and get it.
We'll be hearing about that next week.
Yeah,
yes.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman. Then at the top of the other page, again, just quickly on these performance measures, there are a couple of performance measures that aren't really within the ability of the department to influence that much. One is has to do with nonstop air destinations from Minnesota, and the other is port tonnage shipped from our ports in Minnesota. And again, so those are just data that we're tracking. They're not really directly within the ability of the department to influence.
Okay.
And then flipping over to the next page, higher since July 1st, 2010. And we have several pages of people who have been hired since that time. It's worth noting, however, that not all of these are new to the department. 82 of these people are actually new employees to the department. The rest of them have been reassigned, promoted, or rehired.
You know, Mr. Peterson, I'm not sure why leadership had us ask for that. Members, I'm kind of sorry we did. I think a quantitative number would have been sufficient, but you know, you did just what I asked you to do. What's that old saying? Oh, no, you did it just the way I asked you to. So thank you for the information. I'm not sure why it's in the packet, but thank you for complying. But the aggregate numbers have been very helpful. Thank you for the work. I know this has been work.
You're welcome, Mr. Chairman. We try to be responsive. The next set of information that was requested had to do with requests or pending requests for personnel. Mm-hmm. And basically what we've attached here by location are the open positions. And you'll see the first, and I apologize in advance because this information is in different formats based upon the location in which the information is generated.
Yes.
So the first set of information has to do with central office. And then if you go flip over to the next page about halfway down, there's a blue heading in that table. That starts at District 1, and that goes to the middle of the next page, District 2, and so on. So, again, my apologies for the different formats, but that's just the way we received it. And
understood.
Fortunately, we didn't have time to kind of clean it all up. So the next set of information that was requested had to do with FTEs by classes of employees. So this the class of employees have to do with the type of work the employee does. And so if you just and this, so this information is provided by type of employee and by fund. So if you flip it over, you'll see the type of employee. We have assistant commissioner, division director, clerical, manager, BAPE, supervisors. And then in the middle column there, you'll see it says fund. And just for the committee's information, Fund 173 is the 911 special revenue fund. The 200 fund is the other special revenue funds. 220 is the airports funds. 250 is the municipal state aid street fund. 260 is the county state aid highway fund. 270 is the trunk highway fund. 300 is the federal fund. And 340 is the transit assistance fund, which is the MBEST.
Right. Is that appendix available of information? Is that available to us somewhere? Or of what those fund numbers mean? You just read them off to us. Is it in here or anywhere?
Mr. Chairman, I don't think it is in there, but we can provide it with the
email would be sufficient to the committee administrator. Thank
okay.
you. Lawsuits.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, lawsuits. You asked for a list of the lawsuits, and basically what we've got here are kind of the general areas in which we have lawsuits outstanding. One has to do with payment of tort claims, and we pay tort claims based upon damage. Typically, it's damage that's done either to a person's property, maybe it's real estate or an improvement to real estate or a vehicle, that because of road construction or disrepair of the road. And our appropriations for that purpose are $761,000 this biennium. And it goes through kind of some of the limits around the tort claims that we pay in there. In number two there, it talks about the 35W bridge collapse. and the way in which damage claims were paid out for those affected by that catastrophe. And number three, then, it talks about eminent domain actions, and basically about 20 to 25% of our property acquisitions for highway purposes are acquired through eminent domain. And if you go towards the bottom, there you kind of see the general costs for right-of-way acquisition. Recent years have ranged from $86 million in 2006 to $47 million in fiscal year 10. And last year we paid about $25 million. So $25 million of that $47 was paid out through eminent domain cases. And then finally, Mr. Chairman, you asked for information about interfund transfers, and on the back side of this sheet you'll see the list of all the interfund transfers from 2010 and those that have been made since the beginning of fiscal year 2011. And just quickly, most of these are just kind of standard business. The first one is a transfer that we make from the department to the Minnesota Management and Budget for our debt service. So we have trunk highway bonds that we borrowed to make highway improvements, and MMB manages our activity to acquire the funds and pay the debt service. And so we just, once a year, we make a transfer to them for all the projected debt service payments that will be required during the next year. Mm-hmm. The next one is kind of a one-time transfer that had to do with money that was not needed for a rush line corridor work that had been appropriated. The next one,
Mr. Peterson,
yes.
Instead of reading all these off, does anyone have specific questions about any one of these transfers? I'm seeing the really big numbers about the middle of the page are probably from the revenue department, I would assume, into the highway to tax user fund.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. Those transfers are from the highway user tax distribution fund to the funds that the revenue eventually flows through to like the municipal state aid, county state aid, and trunk highway fund. That's what those are. And you'll see similar transfers later on, one for each fiscal year.
Specific questions about any of the other transaction members? Well, thank you. This has been very thorough, and I appreciate your the exercise. But huge portions of this actually are very valuable to us, and I think just make us better committee members and better informed as we move forward. We have some challenging times ahead of us, and we're going to be setting a budget here next week. So, members, further questions for Mr. Peterson? Or Mr. Peterson, do you have anything else to wrap up with on this part of the presentation?
No, Mr. Chairman, that's all I have.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Skolman, it's good to hear from you again. If you hadn't talked so much, we might have been out of here several minutes.
I apologize.
Members, do we, Ms. Ellison, do you have anything further for us today, or can you be available for next week, or do you want to come on down and talk to us for a few minutes? We have a wrap-up on public safety, or if you have any more questions for public safety for Mr. Jordahl or Ms. Ellison, that'd be great. Thank you again, Scott. Okay. Members, in the save portion of your folder, staff put the presentation that Ms. Ellison and Commissioner Doman, D-O-H-M-A-N, Mr. Commissioner Doman made to us, on Monday. Any follow-up questions or other discussion? Any wrap-up you want to offer for us, Ms. Ellison?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we finished our presentation last time we were here, so I'm here for any follow-up questions.
I see none at the moment. Thank you for coming back and being available. I appreciate your servant attitude. And I'm sure we'll be chatting again next week as we start putting the budget together.
Right, thank you.
You're welcome. Members, let's see. We will adjust the committee rules pertaining to amendment deadlines to balance opportunity to offer amendments while giving the public input. Okay. This is... next week we're going to hear the finance bills. We have seven or eight bills that have financial implication in our committee. I guess I'll just look this way. So we will hear those.
I don't know, Mr. Chairman. I think they'll be
Back.
It'll be an interesting DFL transportation meeting.
Oh, good. Okay. But we'll have seven or eight finance bills that have we have to hear. We'll hear those on Monday and Tuesday. Please keep some time Monday and Wednesday. Please keep next Friday free so we can wrap up some things. And we'll have one of those bills, I believe the plan is, we're going to have one of those bills will be the bill that will be the finance bill, and we'll offer a delete all amendment. I don't know if we're going to have that ready by Friday or Monday. Anyhow, we will adjust committee rules for amendment deadlines and so on. So there's sufficient time, sufficient being more than 2 or 3 days, for members to consider amendments or public the public may want to comment on things, so on and so forth. So the Monday the 21st, hopefully we'll be do the amendments and have the bill out of here. We can come back Monday evening if we need to, and then we'll be at the Ways and Means Committee on March 23rd. That's the plan. So the timeline or the roadmap, I guess, is the next week and a half is going to be pretty busy, and that's kind of what we're going to be doing. Representative Ornstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to review, what you said that there would be a an opportunity for public comment on the, and this would be the delete all
bill. Yeah.
And so just the delete all amendment, you're anticipating a week from this Friday?
We're going to have that ready by Friday the 18th.
Okay.
I hope to have it ready by Friday the 18th so we can take it up on Monday the 21st.
Okay. Okay. Well, thank you, and I know we're going to meet and we can discuss
see you at
further
4 o'clock
these issues.
And we'll chat further.
Yeah.
Members, anything else come from the committee? If not, we are adjourned.
2-1